Sunday, sunny and 72. Right now, sunshine. It's a little windy. Wind from the northwest at 14, gusting to 23. 69 degrees Kenosha, 68 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very excited to be speaking today on the morning show with Barbara Bratton. For the last 10 years, she has been the director of the Kenosha Public Library, or is it executive director?
Oh, no, we don't do executive, no.
Plain old director, but... The title may be relatively plain and simple, but her responsibilities are vast. And over the last decade, it has been a very exciting and it's sometimes challenging period for the Kenosha Public Library. But certainly Barbara Bratton has helped bring it into a very, very good place. And there are great things that are coming up for the Kenosha Public Library as well. And this is also a great opportunity for us to talk about all of the ways in which public libraries in general have really been innovating, stepping boldly into the 21st century, expanding what they offer, their mission to the community. And certainly the Kenosha Public Library has been a very exciting, sterling example of all that. And we're also going to be talking about a red letter day that is coming up in the middle of July with the opening of the new children's library in Uptown. So we have all of that and much, much more to talk about with Barbara Bratton, who steps down as director of the Kenosha Public Library on the 2nd of August. So just under 2 months from now. But we're appreciative of her making time in a busy schedule to join us here in the studios of WGTD. Barbara Bratton, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. As a great fan of public libraries in general and the Kenosha Public Library in particular, it's always fun to be able to sit down and talk about all that libraries have to offer. I think it would be interesting at the outset for us to be reminded about where you come from originally and also the origins of your interest in libraries. Is this something we would see from very early in your life?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Ohio to two immigrants who came here after World War II. And they were frustrated intellectuals because the war had broken out in Germany where they were born when they were 15. Mm. And so my father was probably the most brilliant man I've ever met. But, you know, he wound up getting a degree through the mail kind of thing, you know, which was the way you did that in the old days. And my mother was trained as a nurse, but, you know, she came to America and never followed through getting her degree here, her certification here. So they were great storytellers, both of them. And our evenings were around the table talking about issues and reading Time magazine from cover to cover. That was my father's thing. Every week, that was his goal. So he kept up on world affairs. that way. And my mother was an incredible storyteller. And all of our children's books came from Germany. So I heard it in two languages.
Wow.
And it was a quiet household because, you know, clearly they had been traumatized in their lives and they were seeking shelter in America and silence. And so we didn't have the television on. We had books and everyone was reading. So for me, stories were magical. And I've kept that in my heart my whole life. I went to college to be a doctor. That was my goal. My sister followed through on that. But I veered off into history because, again, it was storytelling. And storytelling that put everything into perspective. So it was really compelling to me. And one of the classes was to go into the basement where the archives were, and I was totally smitten. And I said, how fast can I get a library degree? What do you do? How do you work in libraries? And I should have known that because I was one of those nerdy little kids in high school that didn't want to go to the football game. She wanted to go to the library after school. So in those days, they didn't have a YA section, a young adult section in a library. You were either in the kids area or the adult area. And I was, you know, reading Alexandre Dumas in high school. That was, you know, those were the days, huh?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you ended up studying library science then?
I did, and it was a master's degree, which is very acceptable in my family. I mean, when you're the child of an immigrant, they expect you to, you know, take advantage of the fact that they left their country for a reason, and you're going to, you know, take advantage of what all the United States has to offer you. So, you know, the options were doctor, lawyer, professor.
Right.
So master's degree got me closer.
Very good. So you have had then quite a storied career in which you've really worked in libraries your entire professional life. And I know.
Actually, I started out, I got married young, which was very romantic, you know, right through the storytelling thing, right? And I got married when I was 20, and I quit school. But then, you know, I was piecemealing it back. And in the meantime, I worked in a hospital pharmacy, which was really enlightening, which was right up my alley because I had all that science background. I started out as pre-med, right? And I loved that job. But I did that for 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So it took me a long time to get my first degree. And then I went right into that master's program after that.
Gotcha. So only later then did you start working in libraries.
Yeah, I was in my 30s before I did that.
And I know you've been in several different places before Kenosha. Yeah. Do you want to list them off?
Well, I was born in Ohio, and that was my first library job in the Cincinnati area. And then I don't know, everybody knows Wayne County, but it's about an hour south of Cleveland. That was more of my home territory there. So I had those two jobs, and then I went off to Illinois. I worked in Gurnee, which is the Warren Newport Public Library, for 7 years. Then I went out to Colorado for 8, and then I came back here for 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
So working in public libraries, I assume these were all public libraries.
They were.
What did working in public libraries feel like compared to what you imagined it would be? Because, of course, it's one thing to be a patron, to show up and, you know, explore versus being the librarian or assistant librarian who's in an office and kind of seeing all this from the other side. Was working in public libraries what you imagined it would be? Was it better? Was it worse? Was it completely different? Or was it largely what you thought it would be?
Well, gee, Greg, you always have the best questions. I never thought about it. But, I mean, off the top of my head, I would say it was better. The public library is unique, right, among libraries. There are so many different kinds of libraries, and don't get me started on that. The poor people who do orientation with me at the library have to hear all about all the different types of libraries and what I would do if I was starting over and all that other kind of stuff. But public libraries are just this bastion of hope, right? I mean, it's the people's university is where you can learn your whole life. And, you know, some people get a slower start like I did. I mean, it took me 10 years to get my first degree, right? And, you know, I have immigrant parents who, you know, they're brilliant, but they didn't get the chance to go to Harvard when they were 18, you know? So for me, it's this, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in your life, what you did before, and whether you're getting a late start or you're 18 and ready to go, you can learn anything there, which is so fascinating to me. And most of my career probably half at this point, was on a reference desk, which is really an interesting place. Because you're learning alongside everybody. For people who are curious about anything, what a great job. Because people ask you these things, and you're like, you know, how do I even approach that? I remember, you know, before the days of deep internet where, you know, they could sort of guess what you meant, you had to have all the spelling right and everything. And like my father, I had a Time magazine subscription, and at night I would just read it from cover to cover just to make sure that I understood how to spell something like Gorbachev. Because, you know, if someone needs to know anything about Gorbachev, you had to have the spelling right. So it was those kinds of things. But, yeah. Anyway, it's just there were questions where, you know, I remember, like, significant questions over the years where a woman came in with her friend and she could, you know, barely ask us the question. And so the friend said she wanted to see online whether there was a database to show child molester offenders, because the girl thought that maybe her boyfriend was molesting her children, and she wanted to see whether he had that history or not, and here he did. Wow. And I mean, talk about life-changing, right? Before the days where everybody understood how to use the internet or where all the information was out there, there were a lot of health questions. People would go to the doctor, and, you know, my generation didn't ask a lot of questions. We had a lot of reverence for anyone with a profession. So if your doctor didn't really, you know, told you a lot but you didn't understand any of it, you would come to the public library afterwards with it written down, what is my condition, and then you would read up on it, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So there, I mean, there are a lot of, like, really great uses. Where I worked in one of the jobs I had in Ohio, there was a company that built organs, like church organs, and they needed to know what the building codes were in Los Angeles and in South Korea, where they were installing these enormous church organs that were really part of the building because they were so large, in a place that had earthquakes. So, I mean, and that was like, that was when what we called links, where we would just do type commands on the internet, because the beginning of the internet was science and government. That's what the information was. Mm-hmm. But you could get the Los Angeles building codes that way. But you needed to know how to do that, right? And so the owner of that company would use us all the time for those fascinating questions. So talk about, you know, talk about interesting. I remember there was a question in Illinois where someone came to the desk and said, we make flammable, or not flammable, non-flammable pajamas for kids. And so what is the temperature at which this particular, you know, fabric would be flammable, kind of thing? And so, yeah.
I mean, going to, like, the library to find out.
Okay.
Wow. Well, that could be a matter of life and death. I mean,
it can. It can. You better give good information.
No kidding.
No.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Barbara Bratton, director of the Kenosha Public Library. I mean, she has been that for the last 10 years, but is stepping down into retirement on the 2nd of August. So you've already broached what I thought was one of the most important things for us to talk about today. And it's also something that is very evident, of course, to anybody who walks into a public library now, who remembers walking into a public library 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 30 years ago. And that is, of course, how much libraries have changed. And, of course, over the course of your career as a librarian, you more than anybody is probably aware of the ways in which libraries have deepened their offerings, expanded their offerings. What would you say are the most significant changes that have occurred? And from the librarian's point of view, what have the challenges been for you in terms of facilitating those kind of changes?
Well, I think libraries started out as places for individuals to interact with. You know, you and I would go to the library and figure out what we wanted to know, and we would check out the books or study at a table by ourselves. And then it became more of a collaborative thing. So library programming started to happen where people would learn together. And you would have conference rooms and meeting rooms and things like that where people collaboratively learned. And then, of course, the formats changed, and so our buildings could change. We didn't need as many books when things were also online. And that changes, it's different for different places. We had talked about Seattle this morning. So Seattle, you know, the people in Seattle were early adopters of online things. And so if you go to Seattle, you'll see a lot of open spaces in their libraries. Kenosha, not so fast to change. We are still not at that 50% online use, you know, ebook type of use versus print. Print is still very strong here. So, you know, it kind of depends where you are. But obviously, if you've been to Southwest lately, there's a lot less books and there's a lot more open space where people use tables, where there's tutoring happening, where people are working in groups, and not as quiet as it used to be. But children's programming is just off the charts. I mean, yeah. I mean, our programming numbers, we're breaking records now about how many people come to our programs. So to be together is really important, especially after the pandemic. It was a slow return, but it's a big deal. So there's all these other factors, you know, the factors of different formats of information, clearly, and has really changed how we do things. But I don't feel like we do different things. We have taken on a few things like social services that I wish we didn't have to, but we fill gaps where there are in the community. So we take our service to the community very seriously, and sometimes we venture out into things that aren't traditionally library stuff.
That's exciting, and that might be one of the reasons why a few years ago the Kenosha Public Library earned a really special Library of the Year award. I'm sure that had to feel really, really good for you and your colleagues.
Yeah, especially for the reason being how we responded to the pandemic. And that wasn't an easy thing to do. You know, most libraries remained closed in Wisconsin. But as soon as the order was lifted by the governor, we opened up Uptown. And we did that because we knew that neighborhood really depended on us for access, online access, which included jobs. I mean, how many people lost their jobs during the pandemic, right? So that, just to plug in your phone, you know, a lot of people that are unhoused have phones, but they don't have anywhere to plug them in. And it was also, if you remember, that was a really hot summer. So we're warming centers and we're cooling centers. And so we are very reluctant to close during a storm, like a winter storm or something like that, because, you know, we're warming center. So how we responded and opened up Uptown, and that was right after the civil unrest as well. And that neighborhood got hit hard. So, you know, we were viewed as very brave to go in there. But it was just so gratifying to be there because, you know, the neighborhood – the information got out to the neighborhood pretty fast that we were open, and people were so grateful that we were. And, you know, the Wisconsin library community looked at that and said, wow, that's awesome. So they gave us that award.
Very, very understandably and deservedly. One of the things that you have done is help to lead the way for the Kenosha Public Library when it comes to a bit of automation, particularly when it comes to self-checkout and self-check-in. I'd be really curious to know what was behind that, and was that a particularly complicated process in terms of deciding to do it and deciding how to do it, that kind of thing?
It was very standard wherever else I'd worked, so I was used to it, and I was surprised that we didn't have it. The thing about if you're not automated, you have a lot of human capital, so to speak, in the back room. And we are a service organization. So it seemed to me logical to take away that heavy work that, I mean, that books are heavy. And I would witness ladies, you know, not much younger than me, picking up big totes of books and moving them around. I'm like, oh, this is terrible. We need to automate this. From that perspective, and we could reassign people. And almost everyone who works in, there are some people in public libraries that just, you know, they just are kind of book lovers. They like the atmosphere, the And they don't necessarily want to meet the public, but the majority of them do. They love people and they're service oriented. And so there was a great desire for many of the people in the back room to be out there on that bookmobile or, you know, to be doing children's work. And those were the two areas we really wanted to grow. I already had the staff. They were just, you know, aligned in a different way. So that was very useful. Number two is, as a city department, we compete nicely, but we do compete with other departments for money. And, you know, if you want to grow something like children's or you want to grow outreach department, you don't have the money to add staff. You have to be clever about how you do things. I could get capital money to automate and take away that burden of that load in the back room, and then I could redeploy the people that I already had. So it was a smart financial decision.
I was just thinking the word redeploy. So I was reading your mind, apparently. and it's interesting, because I think a lot of people, when they see that kind of move being made, they see a kind of depersonalization. But you're really describing the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
That is that the person who would be stamping your books or, you know, flicking it under the scanner thing, they're still meeting the public, but meeting the public in probably more meaningful and constructive ways.
Mm-hmm.
And just not just that transaction at the desk, which would actually probably in most cases have to be relatively quick. I mean, you're utilizing these librarians in, let's say, more meaningful ways, and in some ways underscoring the whole personal side of what a library offers.
There's a privacy component to it too. I mean, people can check out their own things and nobody needs to know at the desk what they checked out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Something that was mentioned specifically in I think it was the library's blog that announced your retirement, and as they were lauding you for various accomplishments during your decade as director, one of the things that was mentioned is something that, of course, a whole lot of us have heard about, and that is this whole matter of censorship, of book banning, and as we were chatting before we went on the air, you were really touching on some rather disconcerting examples of that, in which libraries can end up being kind of a battleground, and people who have strong ideas about what should and should not be on those shelves or what should or should not be read want to impose those ideas on other people. And it's a whole side of the world of libraries that a lot of us, you know, maybe we don't think about what somebody like you and your staff might be facing. How big of a challenge has that been in a place like Kenosha?
Well, it depends. I mean, you're asking me. And so for me, I just don't feel like it has been. But I have a different personality than some other people might. First of all, you know, I'm not young anymore. And I don't take anything personally. But I've learned that over the years, right? Not to take things personally. So I think a younger, less experienced person might have felt a little stronger than I did. I know how much the public library is loved in this community. And so I know that I'm not alone. You know, everyone's behind us. And I can also say that I'm old and wise enough to know that the people who appear to oppose us in that way in regard to censorship, I think we all have the same goal. We love our children. We want to protect them. But we have different opinions about how to do that.
Right.
So if we can start from there and agree and not accuse each other of mean-spiritedness, I think we're good. And if you have a clear understanding of history, these things are cyclical. This is not the first and it won't be the last time that public libraries are challenged about what's in their collection. Anytime we have social change, it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And this is how they react. You know, I was raised by a Berliner, and you might as well say a New Yorker. you know, who lived with everyone and you know, never thought, and back in the 60s, never thought that his daughters couldn't be anything they wanted to be in this world. And so, you know, I had no limits in my life. So I have no negative feelings towards anyone who feels like censorship is the right way to do it. But I very much disagree. Hmm.
And of course, it's probably important to say that this works in very different directions. That is, somebody might walk into the public library and not want to see anything that, for instance, celebrates the LGBT community. And someone else might walk into the library and want Gone with the Wind taken off the shelf. I mean, coming from two very, very different perspectives in terms of what they themselves are uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, you at the public library stand in the middle of that and have a lot of things to sort out.
Right. And you know, you can say it in just one sentence. You can summarize our position as we serve everyone. Hmm. And so there should be ideas for everyone. And we should, each of us, should challenge ourselves to explore those ideas a little bit. We may never agree, and I don't expect us to. There are plenty of books that do not appeal to me at all. But why would I keep them out because I don't want to read it? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. So one of the innovations that you helped bring about, in a sense, brings even more possibilities into the library, and that is by the Kenosha Public Library joining the SHARE Consortium. Mm-hmm. And I assume that what we're talking about here is something that at least once upon a time was called interlibrary loan. I don't know if they still call it that, but but it sounds like this is a part of that, but on a really vast, impressive scale.
Yeah, it's a way to automate interlibrary loan, right? Mm. So you could always, as a Kenosha resident, you could always get a book from, say, community library or from, you know, from Racine Public Library if they're the only ones who owned it. But you have to go through a lot of paperwork. Mm. And again, it was one of those ways to allow people to do things themselves and extremely cost effective in comparison. Our integrated library system, which is the software we use to keep records of, you know, patrons and books and, you know, link them together if you check it out and that kind of thing, that cost us $100,000 10 years ago. And it's $60,000 now because we've joined, and 10 years later. Think about that, right? Because we joined a consortium. So it just totally makes sense. And not only that, but you have to meet your customer expectations. You go to the grocery store and check your stuff out. You've been pumping your own gas for a long time. Mm-hmm. So you know what's available out there in the world. And if you look at a catalog of you know, 50, 60,000 items, you know that there's more to it than that. And you judge us if you can't, you know, have access to other things. So big part of my job is to keep the libraries relevant and just make sure that what your expectations are offered through us, right? Same thing with credit cards. We didn't have any credit cards. You know, like you could not pay your fines with the credit card or your lost books or anything like that before I came. I'm like, this is an expectation.
Yeah, right.
Right? And you're going to view us as a very antiquated institution if we don't allow you to check your own things out, or you have to ask a librarian for a book you want. And, you know, that's just not modern, right?
Right, right. That's like the old days when all the groceries were behind the counter and the clerk reached for the detergent or whatever.
That's a long time ago.
That's a long one. Well, and I like that idea that although, I mean, in some ways we can think of libraries, we have sentimental memories of when we were young, but that in fact the last thing you want is for a public library to be so anchored to the past that it isn't, you know, opening you up to the present and all the complexity of the world. And what you're suggesting is the public library can be an incredible place to encounter the world and all that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, of course, that we've touched on is that the library is not just this room with a bunch of books, but it is also a place where stuff happens, where events mm-hmm. happen. And mm-hmm. you have meeting rooms there and all kinds of book clubs and discussion groups and so on. We don't even have time to kind of run down everything, but can you give our listeners who maybe are unaware of this, of just the scope of what I'm talking about?
I think most people know that you can reserve a room, and you need to know that everything is free. Everything is free except making a copy at the library, and it's pretty low cost. Things that you might not expect are a lot of the technology devices are things that you can check out. You can get a hotspot, which is a way to get on the internet for free, and a computer together. That happened during the pandemic. The federal government gave us a lot of money to get those kits together so that, you know, people could actually go to school online and work online during the pandemic. So we have that kind of technology stuff. But we also have, like, you know, big chess sets and all of the play things, too, to check out. We have cookware to check out, those kinds of things. You know, the typical thing, the audio, we have interesting databases. We have MasterClass. I don't know if you guys know about what MasterClass is, but it's video experts on practically every subject you can think of. And I was paying $100 a year for that, just as an individual subscriber, but now we have it for free. So go to our website and check that out. You can just sign up for that. So there's just 100 different ways to learn. And children's programming is just crazy. This summer programming coming up is, oh my gosh, we're having like adult Olympics at Simmons Library Park. I want to witness that. Right. That is going to be interesting. But, you know, 100 different ways to learn. And I know that you're going to ask me about that new children's library. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
This is opening up on the 13th of July, mm-hmm. and it's on the ground floor of the Uptown Lofts. And, of course, this is one example of the exciting redevelopment and rebuilding of that mm-hmm. of that neighborhood. So tell us more about what this particular facility will offer.
Well, you know, I talked about customer expectations, and, you know, we have a real problem with reading in our community. And, you know, it's across the United States, but we're particularly falling behind here, which is surprising to me because I always view the Midwest as such a strong place to learn. I mean, our education system in the Midwest has always been lauded as, you know, the best in the country. But for some reason, our kids, even before the pandemic, were not excelling at reading or math. And during the pandemic, it fell to an all-time low of 27% of our third graders who could read at a third grade level.
Wow.
And, you know, that's shocking. I mean, what's the future of Kenosha if kids can't read? And, you know, maybe you're not a big book fan. You're probably not listening to this if you're not. But, I mean, you know, our summer reading programs now are called Everybody Reads, which is the truth. You have to read.
Everybody should read.
Well, I mean, you don't have to read a long novel to be a reader. You're reading all the time. You're reading signs. You're reading directions. You're reading on the internet. If you're looking at your, you know, Facebook, you're reading. So you have to be able to read, and you have to be able to put things into context for sure. But our kids' reading is surprisingly low because I've been a tutor since I got here in the schools, and I got to tell you, these kids are bright. I don't know what's going on. A lot of us have opinions, and I'm sure the educators that are listening to this are rolling their eyes because I don't mean to infringe upon your brilliance. You're the ones who are trained about how to teach a kid to read, but they're getting taught differently than I was, and I know that there's a movement to go back to the whole phonics thing and, you know, sounding out words instead of sight words. And I know education is always trying to figure out the better way to do things, but
Right. Somehow
our kids are way behind. We're up to last I looked, and I'm pretty sure this is the latest data we have is 36. We're up to 36% of our third graders. Now, our black children fell to 5%. during the pandemic. 5 out of 100 kids. Oh, my goodness. What's their future? And now we're up to 10, but I still think that is just unacceptable. So roundabout way to say we need to find a different way to engage kids with learning. If it is a struggle for them to learn, they're not going to love it. And if we can find a way for them to learn that works for them, great. You know, I've talked to some educators about this, and they've said there is no one way to teach a child to learn to read because everyone learns differently. And I think we can all relate to that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody asked me the other day if I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and I say I try, but I can't keep my mind on what I'm listening to. But I am totally visual. That might be why I love books so much. Give me a book, and I can concentrate for a long time. So we all learn differently, and to have varied ways to learn is an important thing. So we designed that new children's library to be very interactive. Yes, you're surrounded by books, but there's a lot of different ways to learn, whether you're in a group, whether you are interacting with, you know, play things. You're learning science by doing. There's a lot of learning by doing. We've talked to Snap-on about that program they do for some of the schools in Kenosha where, you know, kids learn math by building something. You know, it's much more relevant to them to say what's half of 1 inch if you're looking at a ruler and measuring something out than, you know, using those numbers on a piece of paper that are out of context. So to try to put learning into context with a reward at the end. So we're giving that a shot, you know. But it's colorful and it's playful, and there's just so many, like I said, so many ways to learn. So I think it's going to be a real hit in the community.
Wow. So that grand opening is on July 13th, mm-hmm. and you and I talked about the possibility of maybe WGTD taking our cameras into that mm-hmm. facility and having a video morning show devoted to that facility, and I think that's a fabulous mm-hmm. idea. So I really hope that we'll be able to do that. And so there's things going on, I assume, all day long on the 13th.
We know we're gonna do 12 to 4.
Ah, okay. And the public's invited. And
yep.
All right. So we hope people will mark their calendars for July 13th. You were mentioning before we went on the air that. There have been some instances, particularly, I think you said, out west, where certain public libraries in certain communities have actually been defunded over some of the conflicts that have come about over what should be there, what should be on the shelves, and mm-hmm. so on. And you were saying that in the state of Wisconsin, the way public libraries function, the way they are organized, in a sense, at least to an extent, insulates them from those kind of difficulties and really help make the public libraries in this state as vibrant as they are. Explain the way it happens in Wisconsin.
Nearly all libraries in Wisconsin are city departments. So there's pros and cons to that. Clearly, you're in competition with other departments to spend whatever taxes the city collects. But on the other hand, the way that things are set up is the mayors can has control over the library in only one way, and that is that the mayor is has the authority via statutes to assign the members of the library board, and then the library board has full control over how to spend the money, which is great because that they are the only ones who can really decide on issues like censorship. And if you have the terrific mayors that we have had in our history, they have bowed to that. You know, they haven't tried to overstep that, and they have not appointed people to the library board that come with certain agendas. So these are people who believe in the power of the public library and the good that it can do. They're not all one political viewpoint. They're not all from the same background or anything like that. So they bring diverse viewpoints, but they do, by and large, stand for intellectual freedom, no matter how uncomfortable that can get, because the alternative is not good. Mm-hmm. So it works out really well. That independent library board works really well. And I've worked in four different states. It's not always that way.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were saying before we went on the air, you appreciate the fact that Mayor Antaramian seemed to go out of his way to appoint people to the library board that would align with what you were just talking about. I mean, a real sort of intellectual openness to possibilities beyond their own perspective.
Yeah, he protected the library in a number of ways. We would talk about the need to diversify our board, for instance, and I would bring up particular community members who I thought would be great, and then he would know what longstanding arguments there were out there among the community members. You know, I remember the board telling me this was the biggest small town I would ever work in. You know, there's a long history sometimes between people that I don't know about. And he never wanted the library to become a place where people would work out their individual grievances, right? He didn't want us to be in the middle of that. And so he was sure to make sure that we had people who could work together.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly has made a big, big difference. And I have to say that whenever I have visited the Kenosha Public Library over these many, many years, I have always appreciated the fact that it has grown, become ever more vibrant, ever more relevant in whatever present day we're talking about. And that's never been more true than it is right now. So your retirement comes on August 2nd. What does the next chapter look like? Just a life of leisure? Or do you see yourself somehow being a part of the world of libraries, even in retirement?
Oh, definitely. Definitely part of libraries. But I have so many other interests as well. So my biggest concern is that I will go into paralysis where I won't be able to choose what to do next because I have too many options. But I have a feeling this is the first of many retirements. I'll be doing work somehow. Mm-hmm.
Very good. And I suspect visiting your own local public libraries in one way or another. Well, Barbara Bratton, I'm a big fan of you and of all that you and your staff have accomplished over the years with the Kenosha Public Library. And of course, you were following in the footsteps of some really fine people who came before you.
Definitely.
It's a long, distinguished, impressive history, and you've overseen just the latest chapter, including a chapter that had some very, very steep challenges. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate the way in which you and your colleagues have met those challenges so effectively. Barbara Bratton, the outgoing director of the Kenosha Public Library, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I've always enjoyed our conversations and wish you well in a very busy and fulfilling retirement. And thanks again for being part of The Morning Show today.
Thank you, Greg.
The time is 8:52. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. Today happens to mark the 80th anniversary to the day of D-Day. And here to offer a special commentary on that is a frequent guest to The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear.
From ancient times, military professionals have regarded, rightly, amphibious invasions as especially challenging. We recognize and honor the 80th anniversary of the greatest such operation, the Allies' invasion of France in World War II on June 6, 1944, D-Day. The Normandy invasion combined thorough planning, mobilizing vast materiel, and great imagination. When the enormous operation underway was announced, a U.S. newspaper highlighted a front-page drawing of invading soldiers cascading into Europe as a terrified Hitler fled. A year of extremely brutal, almost continuous combat lay ahead, but the end of Nazi Germany was in sight once the beaches were secured. The leadership of Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower was crucial. Ike demonstrated great executive ability in supervising the enormous planning and brilliant interpersonal skills that welded and held together the most diverse military alliance in history. Remarkably, he was able to establish overall unity of command. This eluded even the American military alone in the Pacific, where General Douglas MacArthur of the Army pursued one strategic vision, while U.S. Navy admirals implemented a different approach. Extensive bombing of transportation routes and supply depots in France was viewed by Eisenhower as crucial preparation. Such action would bring an estimated minimum of 60,000 civilian casualties and perhaps far more. For various reasons, many American and British air commanders resisted, arguing for a more limited effort. Eisenhower was adamant about the absolute need for extensive bombing, arguing that less would put the risky invasion in even graver danger. Free French General Charles de Gaulle agreed and gave unequivocal support. Free French General Charles de Gaulle agreed and gave unequivocal support. Ike had managed to establish an effective working relationship with the insecure, temperamental French leader. Simultaneously, the American commander never lost awareness of the terrible human cost of war, borne primarily by the enlisted ranks. He constantly stressed the fundamentally important role of the combat soldier and regularly went to see troops in the field. This dimension is captured especially by classic photographs of his visit with young American paratroopers preparing to depart to initiate D-Day. Finally, Eisenhower demonstrated brilliant imagination. During heavy fighting for Sicily in 1943, General George S. Patton, Jr. slapped two U.S. soldiers suffering extreme combat stress. Intense controversy resulted. Nazi leaders dismissed the entire matter as propaganda. The German military executed thousands of their own men for various infractions. Ike moved Patton to England to reflect in isolation. Meanwhile, a fictitious army emerged around him. Actors were assigned roles, bogus information generated, phony buildings and vehicles constructed. On D-Day and immediately thereafter, crucial German units remained in reserve, partly because Patton's non-existent forces had not yet moved. Both Eisenhower and Patton were gifted leaders, naturally complementary. The first direct American combat with German forces occurred in early 1943 at Kasserine Pass in Tunisia. Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps devastated inexperienced, often terrified U.S. troops and inept commanders. Approximately 2,000 American soldiers were lost. The vast majority were captured. Many simply surrendered when confronted by the Germans. The already controversial Patton was then appointed commander. About a month thereafter, these same Americans defeated the same Africa Corps at El Guitar. Rommel observed he never saw soldiers more poorly prepared for a real battle or more able to improve rapidly than these Americans. Eisenhower was a gifted leader of Americans and others as well. When he died, President Richard M. Nixon's eulogy compared him to George Washington as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Time brings clarity, including regarding our leaders.
Dr. Art Sear is a monthly visitor to The Morning Show, and his columns appear in newspapers all across the country. The time is 8:58. You're listening to WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jennifer Hollander, author of Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Also from the archives, the author of a book called How Dogs Think. And on Saturday, in the podcast of The Morning Show, I'm replaying a conversation from during the COVID pandemic with three area high school choir directors, Elizabeth Stege, Polly Amborn, and Derek Mahan. Elizabeth and Polly are both retiring after long, impressive careers in public education. So I thought it would be interesting to replay that conversation. That will be tomorrow's, or I should say Saturday's, podcast of The Morning Show. To hear it, you need to subscribe to The Morning Show podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be mostly sunny, windy, and warm. We'll have a high today of 73 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, will be sunny, once again breezy and pleasant, a high of 72 degrees. Mostly sunny on Saturday as well, although there will be a 40% chance of a rain shower on Saturday, again a high of 73 degrees. Sunny and pleasant conditions are expected to continue into early next week, and we may see the low 80s by midweek. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.